this morning. If you're new with us, I want to say welcome. Glad you're here. It's a good week to be here because we're starting a new series. So when I pick new series, we work through the calendar year, and obviously we just finished a series in the life and the writings of Peter, and it really required that you be here like week after week because we were building on ideas one after another through the whole series. And so often when we get to the summer teaching series, I try to find something because I know a lot of you travel and are gone for vacations and in and out. Although we're kind of crowded house this morning, that's not normal for the most of the summer. And so we try to pick things that are kind of one-offs. And so this series is great because, if I don't say so myself, because it's all one-offs. So what we're trying to do is there are a wealth of stories that we're taught. If you grew up in church, that you were taught in Sunday school and vacation Bible school and all those things that you never hear again. So I'm just curious, which ones are that? Which story? Think about stories that you heard in Sunday school growing up that you haven't heard in like 30 years. Yes, Shadrach, Meshach, I was thinking that through, like that's going to be later this summer. We're going to teach that one because I have never heard a teaching on that since I was little. And I have no idea why that story matters. All right, what else? Somebody over here. Balaam and his talking donkey. That's another one. We referred to it a couple weeks ago because it came up in the Peter passage, but we're not teaching that one this year. But it's another one you haven't heard in a long time. What else? Tower of Babel. That one doesn't get done much. We might tack that on to part of our Noah story later on this summer. What else? David and Goliath. Dustin's going to do that one later this summer. Yes. What else? Noah's Ark. We are going to do that one later after the movie comes out on DVD, all right? I didn't get to see the movie in theaters, and we looked it up. It comes out in July, so I gave myself 10 days to watch it, and then I'll teach on it later in August. Jonah. Yeah, we don't do a lot of... I have heard a sermon series on Jonah because the Jonah story is really more fun after the whale when he curses Nineveh and then sits on the tree and cries about it. But it doesn't get talked about a lot. Usually in Sunday school, we talk about the whale and then after the whale, it's all over because it's not that exciting for kids. Yeah, good. What else? Zacchaeus was a wee little man is all we know. That's all we know. We just know a good song. Anything that VeggieTales did a movie on, which was expansive. Yeah. So there's a lot of great stories, right? And so our kids are maybe, I don't even know what they're doing this week, but they might be doing some of those very stories. And yet, for some reason, when we get to grown-up church, it seems like we have to do things that are more grown-up. So there's all these stories that we hear growing up, and then we don't ever hear again. So what we're going to try to do this summer, week after week, is we're just going to try to do the stories again. And we're going to try to get to what are these stories even about. Because I don't know if you're like me, but some of those stories, they were cute and all. There's a bunch of them that we get told in Sunday school that have to do with animals that are cute. But I'm not sure what they have to do with anything. So we're going to work through that this summer. But this morning, I really want to set up the series for a little bit and talk about why stories are important. Now, let's pretend we're meeting for the very first time, right? Let's say you meet somebody in the course of work, and we do our stats. I call them the stats, right? Like, hi, I'm Charlie. Hi, I'm Kyle. Hi, Kyle. You married?
Yep.
Have kids?
Not yet.
Soon. Hopefully really soon. All right, a couple weeks. Where do you work? Yeah, blah, blah, blah. We do all that, right? You do that wherever you go, right? That's what we do in our daily life. You meet somebody, you get their stats, and then there's that awkward, like, that's all. That's all I know. But if you have somebody over to your house and you have a friendship with somebody, what do? You tell stories, right? Well, there was this time when I did this thing and this thing, and we all have our own mythologies, our own stories that we like to tell. In fact, your spouse probably knows better than you the stories that you always like to tell when you're impressing people for the first time. You know, like, here's my accomplishments. But we tell them in story form. Why do we tell stories? What is it about stories that we go to that and we don't just do stats? Like, if you came to my house for dinner, I wouldn't just give you stats all night. Here's how much I weigh. Here's my cholesterol level. Here's how many children I have. Here's the days they were born. We wouldn't just do that. Why do we tell stories? They're entertaining. Yes. Tony. They're more dramatic. You can exaggerate. I can look better. Yes. Yeah, you find a shared experiences. I mean, how boring is it to relate over, I have four kids. I have four kids too. Woo! But when we share our story, like, you went to that one place? Well, I went to that place, and here was my experience. Yes. It reveals your humanity? Yes. Yeah. Oh, I love that. Yeah. It's not just the numbers, but it's the why. When people ask me, this is why I get upset. I don't really care at some level when pastors get together and ask, how big is your church? I understand why we ask that. But it's not the most interesting thing about our church, right? The most interesting thing for about you is not how many kids you have or how much you make or where you work. What's much more interesting about you is the why you have that many kids and why you work where you work and why you are who you are. That's awesome. I love that, Marche. Yeah. I love that you're an accountant and you just said that. That's awesome. Like, you're a numbers guy. But yes, it's that. Like, it's bigger than numbers. It tells more about the emotional content of who I am, a big part of who I am. Yeah. Couple more. Yeah, because you can't tell intimacy through numbers, right? You don't get stats to get to intimacy. Yeah. Yeah, people like stories. Yes. You own what you say. Good. Couple more. You guys are all over this. Yeah. They stick with us. Stories are memorable, big time. Yes. Yeah, so you get a lot more sense of the journey, not just the details, okay? So stories do three things for us, right? And you guys have said a lot of these things. First of all, stories are memorable, right? Some of these stories that we're going to talk about, you haven't heard since you were 10 years old, sitting in Sunday school class in your small little church in Podunk Town, all right? But you remember those, right? Like, there's all kinds of stories that we, like, okay, so you've heard this one. You may not have heard this one for years, but you've heard it. A hare was once boasting of his speed before the other animals. You know this one, right? It's an Aesop fable, the tortoise and the hare. You just know it. Like, I say David and Goliath, and you have very visual, like, you remember most of the details of the story. Not only is a story memorable, but it's also textured and nuanced. I can tell you stats about me. I can tell you, okay, I'll pick on one. I can tell you I've run 2 marathons in the last 2 years. That's a stat, right? But I can tell you stories about why I ran the marathon, and it's so much more textured than that. There's so much more to that story. The first marathon I ran at the end of a journey of losing about 70 pounds. That's a much better story, right? That's a much more interesting thing to talk about, and it's much more textured, and it means a whole lot more than simply, I ran out and ran a marathon. Well, congratulations, thousands of people every year run marathons. Who cares, right? But the story is much more textured, and then we can get to nuances that we just can't get by giving stats. Is then a story invites interpretation. We choose our stories. So think about even the stories that we tell. When you meet somebody for the very first time, they've come over to your house for dinner, or you've met for coffee, and you're sitting down and you're telling a story. You tell stories about yourself because you want to be interpreted a certain way, right? We all have our hero stories. The stories where we look really good. But then as we get closer to people, we start letting them in, and we start telling the stories that, boy, I wouldn't tell this story to everybody. I wouldn't share this thing with everybody, but I'm sharing it with you. And those stories, too, they invite interpretation. And so the stories that we're going to get to this summer, the stories in Scripture, they come about because they are memorable and they're nuanced and textured. So what they teach us about God and about the people of Israel and the characters in the story, we're going to find are super textured and nuanced. For example, in a couple weeks, Mandy's going to teach us about Samson. Talk about a textured and nuanced character who's held up as a hero on one hand, but is really, really immoral on the other. And he's really just not a good person, right? And we get all these characters. If you look through the Hebrew Scriptures, you find all these characters that are super textured and super nuanced, and you just can't do that through giving stats. What's interesting is when God chooses to reveal himself. This is why this whole series is important. When God chooses to reveal himself, yes, there are places where God gives law, but most of the Hebrew Scriptures are made up of stories, right? Most of the pages, if you read through your Hebrew Scriptures, of course, you read stories right out of the bat, and then you get to a long section of law giving, and then you get right back into stories. And I would argue even the prophets and the Psalms, they're a little bit different than the stories, but most of those, I don't know if any of you have ever read a chronological Bible, but this is where chronological Bible reading is great, because it takes the Psalms and the prophets and puts them into the story, so you get to see how they're also part of the story. And all of this, it all comes to us in story. Now, I know that there are some of you, engineer types among us, that wish the whole Bible were written like the Apostle Paul, who just gives us long lists of thoughts and ideas and serious reading, right? But for some reason, God chose to reveal himself in stories that play well to children. And so I think that's important for us. I think it's important for us to dive in and study and read and understand, like, why does God choose to reveal himself in stories? And I would say that one of the reasons is because it invites us into interpretation. It invites us in to wrestle with God, which is the first teaching that I'm going to do next week. So real quick, a little bit of academia for all of you is, where do these stories come from? Well, this summer, we're going to stay in the Old Testament, all right? We're going to stay in the stories pre-Jesus. Now, I want to say a couple things about that. First of all, you will hear me most of the time refer to the Old Testament as Hebrew Scriptures, all right? Old Testament is fine, but I think for some of us, it gives this idea that it's irrelevant. When we hear old, it's irrelevant. It's no longer useful. And I think that's a bad thing. Jews refer to this as the Tanakh, the Torah, the Nevi'im, and the Ketuvim together, TNK, Tanakh. So what most people have gone to these days, at least most scholars have gone to, is calling it the Hebrew Scriptures as a way to not, you know, cloud it anyway, or whatever the word is that I can't find right now. So these writings, all right, those three sections, Torah is the law, the first five books, then the prophets and the writings are a collection of things. You can look in and see that more if you're really into that. These writings come across, they develop over about 1,000 years or more, all right? So I need to give you a little bit of story to help you understand how this all comes to being. So when Israel finds itself in captivity, post 722 or 586 BC, Israel's taken into captivity. They're in Babylon, right? And so if you know any of the story, you know that they were God's people. God promised them a land, and now they live in Babylon. They have no land. They're not even sure that they have God anymore, right? And so when they get to Babylon, one of the concerns of the people is, the big question is, are we still God's people? You understand how they would get there? Like, they're in captivity. God promised them a land, and now they don't have a land. And so are we still a people? Is this still our thing? Are we still, are we that? And so they begin to question themselves, and what we see in the captivity is the compilation of the Tanakh. They start gathering sources. So some of the things we find in the Hebrew scriptures are thousands of years old. There are things in Judges and Joshua that appear to be written in like Canaanite form. They are super, super old. The story of Job seems to be super, super old. But there's other things, like, for example, Isaiah, where we know that there's multiple authors in the book of Isaiah that seem to be really, really relevant to this time, that they seem to be compiling sources that are really old. They seem to be writing stuff that's fairly new. There's some people that think the Noah story doesn't come about until this time. When the Israelites encountered the Gilgamesh epic, that they then started writing the Noah story. We'll get into that whole thing later, all right? Don't get distracted by it right now. The point is that Hebrew scriptures, around the time of the captivity, about 5th or 6th century BC, these scriptures become put together because they're after this question, who are we as God's people? And that's part of why we're going to do this. We're not just doing this because it's a fun series and it's easy one-offs to do all summer, but we're doing it. Part of it is when we get into the stories, we start asking ourselves the same question. What does it mean to be God's people? What do these stories tell us about the character of God, who we are, who God is, all those things? So we need some guiding questions as we go along in this, all right? We need some way for us to orient ourselves. And so I've given, obviously during the summer, I'm going to take some weeks off. I think I'm only gone one of them. I'll be here most of them. But we've asked some other people to teach along the way. Mandy's going to teach a couple. Jeff's going to teach one. Dustin's going to teach a couple, I think. And I have given them lots of liberty. Pick whatever you want. Teach whatever you want. Just have fun with it. But I've given them a couple guiding questions, all right? So these are the things that we're going to wrestle with, is where are we, first of all, in the big story? So I've been working on a project where I've been going back through all of our teachings since we started 6 years ago and compiling a list of everything that has been taught on Sunday morning at Imago Dei Church since March 23rd, 2008. All right. So just kind of, we're working on it with our formation team, just kind of to look at the big picture, like what's our balance? What have we taught? What have we haven't taught? What should we be teaching? Kind of looking forward. Okay. This has kind of been fun because I've forgotten stuff that we taught. And then there's other things I'm like, I taught that? I have no idea what I said about those things. Like a couple years ago, I did a series that we called The Story, and maybe none of you remember this. I did not create these six C's. You can blame or credit Brian McLaren, however you want to blame or credit, because it's just too neat and tidy for me. But he says that when we talk about the big story of God in Scripture, this is a grid work for understanding that story. He actually has a couple more that go after Jesus, but that's not for us this summer. So let me recap this, right? So the big story of God looks like this. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and we have the creation story, and we have Adam and Eve in the garden. And what we're supposed to get from that story, I think, is this idea that in the original creation, God created everything, and it was good. It was good. Not perfect. Remember, we've talked about this before. It wasn't perfect, but it was good. So good has the idea that it's good and it's going to keep moving forward, that they're going to cultivate the land. They're going to bring it to order. And so in the creation, we see Adam and Eve living at harmony with God. The text tells us that they walked with God in the garden. So they have this really intimate relationship with God. Like just, hey, God and I, we're going to go for a walk. All right. Just that kind of intimacy. And it says that they also have this deep intimacy with each other, that they are naked and they know no shame. Nobody will ever let me read that at their wedding. And I always want to read that part and nobody will let me because it says naked in it. But that's what the text tells us, is it's a symbol that they are just, you know, like no shame, nothing between them. There's none of that for those of us that are married more than a week, like none of that stuff that gets between us sometimes that makes us like, none of that. And it says, so they lived in harmony with God, and they lived in harmony with each other, and they lived in harmony with the creation, that they lived in the creation in a way that they lived in harmony with that. And what we see in the crisis is they choose to not do what God asked them to do. Hey, here's what I've created for you. Here's what is good. Here's the good way to live. And they chose the other way. They chose the road less traveled. They went the other direction. And so we see crisis, and we see then in that, what do we think about those three categories? We see their relationship with God now difficult and broken. We see their relationship with each other difficult and broken. They blame each other and hide from God. We see their relationship with the creation now much harder, that you're going to have to dig and there's going to be weeds. You know, like we see this crisis and it looks bad. And that's not the end of the crisis. The crisis keeps going. The crisis then says, okay, this is what their choices were. And then what's the next story after they get kicked out of the garden? Not only are your choices here, but who's next? This goes to your kids. We get Cain and Abel story, which is another one. Anybody heard since Sunday school? Very few of us, maybe nobody. That it not only is in you, but this now is in your kids too. And the story after that, I think, is it the Noah story right after Cain and Abel, or really shortly thereafter? We get to the Noah story, we get to the Babel story. We just get these stories of like crisis. This thing is not just about who took an apple from the tree or whatever. It's much bigger, and it has implications for everything. And then we're introduced to a man named Abraham. Remember Abraham and the covenant? And you, listen, Abraham, through you I will bless everyone. And then out of Abraham, we get the nation of Israel, and we begin to see these cycles. We get to see these people who are trying to be in relationship with God, who are trying to be faithful to their side of the covenant, knowing that if we can be faithful to God, God will be faithful to us. And we see the people of Israel then come out of Egypt. We see them develop. We see the judges, and we see these cycles really poignantly in the judges, and which Mandy will get to with Samson, and then I think she's going to teach Gideon later on. But we're going to get to these cycles of, hey, these people, they follow God for a while, and things are good. And then they stop following God and things are bad. And then they choose to follow God again and things are good. And then they stop and things are bad. And we see this over, this churning and churning and churning. And then we get to the people of Israel. They come into the land finally and they become a nation. And we see the kingdom, David, then Solomon, the kings. And there's good times and then there's evil. And it's always churning, cycling in and out of being faithful to God and then not being faithful and seeing the consequences of that until we get to the place of exile. And then we find in our Bibles at the back part of that conversations about what this all means. We can find the prophets and the writings, and we find all these things where people are wrestling with what does it mean to be God's people, and if we just return to God, things will be better, and we find that they just never can. And if you've ever read the Hebrew Scriptures beginning to end, here's my experience. When you read the Hebrew Scriptures beginning to end, it's just frustrating. You ever read a novel and you just get so frustrated with the characters that by the end you're just like, it's like Breaking Bad, right? Like you don't like anybody. By the end of Breaking Bad, I hated them all, right? Hate's a strong word. I did not like any character. I liked Jesse a little, but he's still a criminal, right? Like it's just hard to find people you like. It's hard in the Hebrew Scriptures to find people you like because they just, oh, come on, stop making such dumb choices. We don't use the word dumb in our house. Bad choices, unwise choices, right? So, All these conversations happen until we get to Jesus and we find, and I love the words of a certain theologian who will not be named, who says that because we couldn't be faithful to the covenant, God had to come and be faithful on our behalf. And so in Jesus, we find that covenant completed. Jesus is faithful for us. And I know I've done that recap in 5 minutes, by the way. That's a long elevator spiel on a very tall building. But that's the 5 minute story of what God is doing in all of Scripture. And one of our tasks this summer, and one of the tasks I've asked the teachers, is to help us understand where these stories fall in this. Where does Jonah fall in that? What does Jonah have to do with that? What does Babel have to do with that? What does Elisha and having the kids getting mauled by bears have to do with that? Where does that fit? And yes, we will talk about Elisha and the bears, all right? So what is it? And then the second thing we need to ask ourselves all the time is, what is the context? Now, the difficulty is this. If I tell you a story about one of the stories I know that I tell people pretty, like if I met you, if you came over to my house tonight for dinner, one of the stories I would tell you is how I built our first home. My dad and I built our home. And I would tell you about all the work, and I might even get out the picture album and show you the 6 months that we were working and, you know, blood, sweat, and tears, literally, just in the process. And I would talk to you, I love doing this stuff. Like, and I'd tell you like how fun it was and how hard it was and fun and hard and fun and hard and how our kids were little. I would tell you, that would be part of the story I would tell you. And you all would get that, right? Because you could mentally picture, you've all seen a house being built. You can all mentally picture what it's like to build a house. And you all could think about what your life would be like if you were building a house. Like, you know, the pattern of go to work and then go to the house and work until 10 o'clock at night and then go home and sleep and get up and do it again. Come to church from 7 to 4 or 5, go out to the house. You all can imagine that life, right? Right? You can imagine what that life might be like because it's close to what we are. One of the struggles that we have with these kinds of stories is some of these stories are at least 3,000 years old. And so some of the context in these stories is really, really difficult. For example, I'm going to steal just a little bit of Dustin's thunder because it's 2 months away and you'll forget everything I've said by then. But part of the David and Goliath story that's really hard for us is we don't have any context for this story. We don't generally settle disputes by saying, we're going to put a Barack Obama up against you, the leader of your country, and whoever wins will be your slaves forever, right? Like, that doesn't seem to us like a good way to do battle, all right? Because, like, what if our guy had a bad day? You know, what if just things didn't go well? And as confident as we think our guy could be, he might lose, you know? Like the Germans kind of lost yesterday, or like, you know, like it's like world, what if the outcome of nations was built on the World Cup, you know, like, all right, whoever wins this match today, the other team has to be their slaves, right? Like, that's what they're doing in this story, and we just can't even understand the context for something like that. And so often what happens is because we don't understand context, we get at this really surfacey level of the story. For example, the Noah story. What's the Noah story about? Well, clearly, it's about God loves animals. God loves cute little animals, and God loves nursery design and was just looking to build in something you could decorate your nursery with in a biblical theme. And Rahab seems weird, right? So context really, really matters. And so one of the things we're going to try to do as we work through the series is to help you get your mind around context. How would the first hearers of this story have heard this story, right? Does that make sense? Like, what we're trying to get after is, if you're the first person to hear this story, if you're the person that said, I'm going to write this story down, why did you do that? Why did you think that Elisha and the bears was something so important that it had to be written down? And then why did you think it was so important that we need to make sure that it's in the Tanakh? We can't publish this without that story in there. Why? Why did they think that? Why did they think David and Goliath had to be in there? What is that trying to tell us? And so we're going to pay a lot of attention to context. And then the big question here is, which details matter? So when I tell you a story, details. Have you ever been with somebody that's a bad storyteller? Or, like, it's also the person that's a bad joke teller. Same person, right? The person who's trying to tell you a joke, and then they get to the punchline, and they say, oh, wait, I forgot one of the details. And it's the main detail. It's the one that actually makes it kind of funny, but now it doesn't make any sense. Or the person that's telling a story and they get to the spot and they're like, oh, I didn't tell you. Oh, yeah, I'm related to that person. Well, that would have been helpful this whole story long. It's been really convoluted. You've been with bad storytellers. Well, good storytelling, details matter. And so what we have to do as we work through this is we have to pay attention to details. We've got to look at why do they use this word so much? Why is this detail important in the text? Often, like in the stories of Jesus, location matters. Well, this happened about this in this region. Oh, well, okay, if it happened in the mountains, I understand why it happened that way, and it didn't happen on the plains, or it didn't happen next to the ocean. That matters in the telling of the story, right? And so we're going to pay attention to details. So turn to 2 Samuel 11 for just a minute. We're not going to do this story in depth, and I've alluded to this a story before, but I just want to read it, and we're going to pay attention to some details for just a minute. So this story is David and Bathsheba, all right? So we all know what this story's about, right? This story's about adultery, right? That's what it's always about. And if you ever watch any movies on the Old Testament, this one's a fun one, because this gets you PG-13. So 2 Samuel 11. I'm just going to read the narrative, and I'm going to emphasize details, all right? Particularly one detail. In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Raba, but David remained in Jerusalem. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "She is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah Hittite." Then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him and he slept with her. Now she was purifying herself from her monthly uncleanness. Then she went back home. The woman conceived and sent word to David saying, "I am pregnant." So David sent this word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And Joab sent him to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked him how Joab was, how the soldiers were, and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." So Uriah left the palace, and a gift from the king was sent after him. But Uriah slept at the entrance to the palace with all his master's servants and did not go down to the house. David was told Uriah did not go home. So he asked Uriah, "Haven't you just come from a military campaign? Why didn't you go home?" Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my commander Joab and my lord's men are camped in the open country. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and make love to my wife? As surely as you live, I will not do such a thing." Then David said to him, "Stay here one more day, and tomorrow I will send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. At David's invitation, he ate and drank with him, and David made him drunk. But in the evening, Uriah went out to sleep on his mat among his master's servants. He did not go home. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it with Uriah. In it, he wrote, "Put Uriah out on the front where the fighting is fiercest, then withdraw from him so he will be struck down and die." So while Joab had the city under siege, he put Uriah at a place where he knew the strongest defenders were. And when the men of the city came out and fought against Joab, some of the men in David's army fell. Moreover, Uriah the Hittite died. Joab sent David a full account of the battle. He instructed the messenger, "When you have finished giving the king his account of battle, the king's anger may flare up, and he may ask you, 'Why did you get so close to this city to fight? Didn't you know they would shoot arrows from the wall? Who killed Abimelech, son of Jerubbaal? Didn't a woman drop an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died in Thebez? Why did you get so close to the wall?' If he asks you this, then say to him, 'Moreover, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead.'" The messenger set out, and when he arrived, he told everything Joab had sent him to say. The messenger said to David, "The men overpowered us and came out against us in the open, but we drove them back to the entrance of the city gate. Then the archers shot arrows at your servants from the wall, and some of the king's men died. Moreover, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead." And David told the messenger, "Say this to Joab, 'Don't let this upset you. The sword devours one as well as the other. Press the attack against the city and destroy it.' Say this to encourage Joab." When Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. And after the time of mourning was over, David had her brought to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing David had done displeased the Lord. And then this line, "The Lord sent Nathan to David." the rest of the story goes on in verse 12 that Nathan comes and he tells the story about the rich man and the sheep and all that parable. And David says the man should die. And Nathan says, you are that man. And so the child dies, and on down through the story. Verse 29 of chapter 12. Verse 26. Meanwhile, Joab fought against Reba of the Ammonites and captured the royal citadel. Joab then sent messengers to David saying, I have fought against Reba and taken its water supply. Now muster the rest of the troops and besiege the city and capture it. Otherwise, I will take the city and it will be named after me. So David mustered the entire army and went to Reba and attacked and captured it. David took the crown from the king's head and it was placed on his own head. It weighed a talent of gold and it was set with precious stones. And David took a great quantity of plunder from the city and brought out the people who were there, consigning them to labor with saws and with picks and axes. And he made them work at brick making. David did all this to the Ammonite towns. Then he and his army returned to Jerusalem. Now, there's a lot of things in this story. So stories are obviously, if you've read a good novel, you know that there's plots and there's subplots, right? And sometimes subplots of subplots. And I'm reading this novel right now that has, I'm pretty sure, subplots of subplots of subplots. And I'm a third of the way, not even a third, I'm 8% into the book and completely confused. But this story has a lot of details that can get us off course, right? And there's a lot of salacious things. There's a lot of stuff happening, right? So what's this story about? If details matter, what does this story seem to be about? What was I emphasizing? Sent. If you look at the whole text of 1 Samuel, or 2 Samuel, I can't remember the number. Eugene Peterson years ago pointed this out, that I think it's something like 50% of the usages of a single verb appear in one chapter. The writer is clearly choosing a verb and using that verb over and over and over again because he's trying to make a point. And the point seems to be what? Tell me what happens at the beginning of this thing. What's David doing? He's abdicating his responsibility. In the springtime, when kings go off to war, what David's supposed to be doing as the king, what is David actually doing? Okay, let me put it in our context. At 9 o'clock Monday morning, when people are supposed to be going off to work, he's flipping and watching HBO because he just doesn't want to work today, right? That's kind of what he's doing. David is supposed to be going off to war. Instead, he's walking around his palace looking down at the lady bathing on a roof down below, right? That's what he's doing. And then David uses his kingly power. What does it say? Does it say that she looked up and was like, hey, I'm going to go hang out with the king? What happens? David sends for her and makes her come. Now, he's the king and he has the authority to do this. What they do then is not consensual. Clear? Not consensual. David's using his authority and his power. And then David does what? After he sends for her and finds out she's pregnant, he does what? He sends for Uriah. Then he sends for Joab. And we see David using all his power to do what? To cover his tracks. To do evil, to cover up what he's done. He's using the power that God gave him, the position that God gave him. He's using that to cover his own tracks because what he's done is wrong. And the story hinges then on verse 12 or chapter 12 when it says, all right, God's going to put an end to it because then God sends Nathan. God gets involved. And then at the end of the story concludes when what happens? Joab then says, hey, David, do you want your place back? Do you want to step into what God has put you in position to do, or do you want to just keep walking around the top of the palace and look where it got you? And so the story ends then with David going out and joining his army on the battlefield, and you know, see all that. You see how details matter? So when we're doing these stories, one of the things we have to do, and one of the things that's hard, again, 3,000 years later, is we have to work through what are the details in this story, and details matter. It's going to matter when we get to Dustin's. It's going to matter that Goliath comes to the battlefield with armor and an armor bearer, and David comes with a sling. Those details matter to the story. All right? And so as we work through these, we're going to be talking context. What's the context 3,000 years ago? But then also, what are the details? What are the writers hoping that we pick up on and we lose because it's so far away and we're talking a different language and all those things? What are they hoping that we get? All right? So here's the stories we're going to do. And I'm going to wrap up this morning shortly. So here's the stories that we landed on. You guys all, I asked you to give me ideas. So these are the ones that, a combination of what you suggested and then a couple that we just wanted to do. So the first one, nobody requested, but I just really wanted to do. This one is the story where Jacob wrestles with someone all night. Remember, it's on the night before he meets with his brother Esau to make up after he stole the inheritance. And so Jacob wrestles with God all night and his name gets changed to Israel. So I'm going to steal my punchline next week. The name of Israel, their nation's name, is wrestles with God. Oh, I love that. Yes. So we're going to do that. And then the week after that, I told you Manny is going to talk about Samson. The week after that, we have not settled on what we're going to do yet that week. The week after that, we're going to do the Ezekiel 37 passage, the Valley of Dry Bones. We sing a song here about the Valley of Dry Bones. And if you ever, if somebody comes in new for the first time and we start singing about bones, it's weird, right? Like we've talked about, it's like one of those songs we feel like we have to intro every single time we do. And it's a great song, but it has to be introed every time. Then we're going to do Elisha and the Bears. I have no idea what we're going to say about that one. That's the one, if you're not familiar, where these kids come out and call Elisha Baldy. So he calls the bears out and the bear mauls 42 children. Has not everybody heard this story? All right. If not, you will. People that are like, have an atheistic leaning really point to stories like this. Like this, this is who God is, that kids call a prophet Baldy, and he's so insecure about his lack of hair that he calls bears out to maul these kids, and God's cool with that. I hope that disturbs you just a little bit, right? That should disturb us a little bit. We'll unpack that. I hope I have something to say. Then David versus Goliath. David and Goliath has become iconic, and so we're going to try to mess with that one just a little bit. Noah, I don't know what we're going to do with Noah, but I'm going to watch the movie first, and we're going to talk about the movie. Apparently, Cosmos has been talked about Noah several times, so I'm going to try to catch up on Cosmos episodes, and we're going to say some stuff about Noah when we get there. Somebody said Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, the three friends that get thrown in the fiery furnace. We're going to talk about them and what happened there. Gideon's a great one. Gideon is the guy who throws out the fleece and leads God's armies, but continually, he's not evil like Samson seems to be, but he seems like a terrible leader who constantly doubts God, and it's like, I don't think we can do this. No, don't think you can do it. And then finally, I don't know what you're doing with Joseph. The last week, you're going to talk about Joseph. Something. There's several stories from the life of Joseph. Dustin's going to find one to do. All right? If this goes well, if you all enjoy this, maybe next summer we'll do part two, and at maybe some point we'll do New Testament stories. Let me finish with one thing. What are we supposed to do with these stories? Two things I want to say real fast is, first of all, we have to deconstruct. Sorry, but when we've reduced stories that we heard in Sunday school to, oh, the Noah thing is so cute with the animals, we've got some deconstructing to do of these stories, right? That there's a mythology that's built up around some of these stories because they had animals and they're cute, that we're going to have to take some of them. I'm sorry that we might poke at your beloved stories, but we might have to poke at some of them and say, you know what? Maybe the story isn't saying what we've always thought it was said. And when we look at the context, when we look at the details, well, the David story is a good example. When we look at the context, when you look at the details, okay, yeah, we all know that adultery is bad, but this isn't the story that's about that. That's not the point of this. It's bad along the way, and getting Uriah drunk along the way and getting him killed, those are all bad things. But that's not the main point that this is trying to make. And sometimes the details of the story, because they're really interesting to us, make us miss the big picture. And so we're just going to have to deconstruct some of these stories and tear them apart and say, okay, these details that always got emphasized aren't the most important details here. Maybe this detail over here is much more important. Does that make sense? And then the other thing that I want you to do is discuss, also known as argue, debate, interpret. The beautiful thing, and again, I'm going to lean into this next week a lot. One of the beautiful things about Judaism is this is the flavor of Judaism. That over thousands of years, these stories have been interpreted and debated and argued about and asked about, what do they mean? Well, it means this. Well, no, it clearly means this. And they've been arguing about this ever since. And I think that's good. We should, when it comes to stories, wrestle with, what does it mean, and why does it mean this, and I'm not sure. And so I want to invite you, open season, to disagree with everything we say up here and to dig into it for yourself. Read the details, read the stories, read other stuff. Talk to people you know, see what they think it means, and let's open season to argue and debate and interpret. I don't know how that's different than any other time at our church, but I'm just saying it's fine, open season. And then if you really want to lean in, start reading ahead. Start reading the stories and start forming what you think before you step in here. Because I know we're going to try to tell you the stories, but in some cases, like this one, I read one of the two chapters. Some of these stories take chapters and chapters to set up the story, and sometimes background that will take a long time to do as well. And the more you know coming in, the better it'll be for you, all right? So next week, we'll try to give you the text each week for the coming week. The text next week is Genesis 32, 22 to 32, Jacob wrestling with the angel, okay? And then let me pray, and then we're going to see off the Honduras team. God, be with us this summer in these stories. I pray that you use these stories in our body to challenge us to think about you in nuanced and complex ways. And that, God, some of us, these stories are really fuzzy and we haven't heard them in a long time. Help us to put them in a framework that helps us understand the big story of what you're doing in the world. And so be with us throughout the summer. I know that a lot of us are going to be in and out and in and out and off, and it's a busy time. But just I pray that the weeks that we're here, that we're really able to sink our teeth into things this year. Be with the different teachers that are teaching and give them insight and wisdom as they teach us. In your name I pray. Amen.